mourning a pillar of our republic as long as it still lasts. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
It's really great to be back with you, Barry, today on this Friday as we record this, the day before it's going to play. And today I'm really looking forward to it because it's going to be like 55 degrees here. My wife and I are camping out in our new house as we wait for the carpet to be installed, because once the carpet is installed, we can actually move in. So we are doing work, painting baseboards and all kinds of things so we don't ruin the new carpet. So it's a good day today. Anytime it's more than 50 degrees in the middle of February or near in the third week of February, I'm happy.
Well, I guess that even though a groundhog may have seen his shadow somewhere in Ohio or Pennsylvania on the 2nd of February, you know, you turn the clock ahead just a little under 3 weeks, and we have these bright sunny days that are happening. Now, you know, again, Chuck, we do live in Ohio, so therefore just wait 5 minutes. If you don't like the weather, it'll change, the old saying goes. But, you know, it's nice because, you know, coming out of the doldrums of winter and having bright, warm sun coming and things starting to maybe dry out a little bit. I know in our area we've had a little bit of snow and a lot of rain, and I think it's been flipped on your end with a lot of snow and a little bit of rain. And so I was just kind of wondering, are they floating that carpet in on a John boat to your new
Well, on the night of the big snowfall, I think we had between 4 and 6 inches out here. My wife and I had stayed overnight. We actually had come out to work in the place. We weren't planning on staying overnight. And by the time we got ready to go home, the roads were, you almost couldn't see them. But by the next day, by the end of the next day, they pretty much had them all plowed out, and I'm out in the country. So, you know, it wasn't horrible. When we went back into town, we could actually see the roads. That at 10 o'clock that night, we did go into town and we couldn't see the roads. So we kind of plowed our own road as we went. You know, that's the kind of thing that you deal with out here in the country, as you're more than well aware.
Well, yes, but I have to give a great hat tip to, at least in my county, our county engineer and our road crews, because, you know, when we get these big snows, our roads out here, we live right off of a main state route, and our roads out here are cleared within a couple of hours of the snow starting to fall. You know, we've got trucks coming through here, and they're keeping these roads clear. And I've noticed, because, Chuck, you know, I travel all over the place, all over the state and all over the region, and I've really noticed that in the, you know, during times of snow, it's the places that are really, you know, well, we say, as you said, out in the sticks, in the country, that the folks know how to keep the roads clear. Because then as I got closer to the cities, you know, moving toward Columbus from where I am, the farther I went, the worse the road conditions got, with the same amount of snow falling everywhere. So, sometimes you just, you know, when you're dealing with areas that have larger municipalities, those areas get an awful lot of attention, but then all the roads around them end up suffering somewhat. But when you live in the country where, you know, they can focus more on what they're doing on the roads in your backwoods and local areas and you know, in the little villages and things, I've noticed, and I just got to say that they do a fantastic job. And I honestly, you know, wouldn't want to trade places with the guys who work on those road crews, who have to be out driving, you know, trucks and blade scrapers and everything else, you know, and maybe run 36-hour shifts sometimes when we get good snows, like you talked about up there with 6 inches. They do a fantastic job of trying to keep everything safe and cleared, and so we can get back and forth. Rarely has it been, you know, during this winter that we've been under even a level 2. I think one time we ended up going to a level 3 for just a little while, because that was the day we had the big snow here earlier during this winter. So
yeah, what you're basically saying is something that we've been touting here for quite some time, and that is localism works.
Yes, indeed, it does.
And well, if you don't understand what we mean by that, you should take our Constitution class. And yes, we're doing our best to form a new Constitution class. So if you want to know more about that, come out to www.principledpolicy.com to find out how to contact us. That's principledpolicy.com. And one of the books that we use in that enterprise is a book called Restoring America One County at a Time. And essentially, the premise of that book is that the Republic was designed to work with localism as the primary mover and shaker of government, not centralization. And Barry, that's one of the things that you've just mentioned, that sometimes, and very often, in fact, your local townships and counties, if they have the tax revenue to do it, actually do a better job of keeping the roads clear. Now, what we had here, I live on a main county road, so this road was cleared very quickly. Some of the side county roads took a little longer, but nonetheless, they were cleared more quickly than I expected them to be.
Yeah, and again, and I think that you know, the less centralized you are, sometimes the better your services become. I know that that goes against the common wisdom, but I've seen it in action. So, you know, Chuck, this is, you know, we say this and we're sitting here kind of reminiscing because, you know, it's nice and warm and it's sunny today. But we have to remember that, you know, we're still into winter for the next month until we change over officially to spring. So anything's liable to happen. But in the interim period, a lot of things, whether it's snowing, freezing cold, or blazing heat, a lot of things are happening around the country, and we need to get into talking about some of those things today. And probably the first and foremost thing that we need to talk about is the and I'm not using the word untimely, Charles, because we believe in God's sovereignty, but the unexpected passing of United States Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who this last weekend was at a retreat at a ranch in West Texas, and who apparently, depending on which news source you look at, Charles, either died peaceably of natural causes, had a heart attack, or there was some nefarious underhanded conspiracy going on because he ran afoul of the Obama regime and was dispatched. And I'm saying that kind of tongue-in-cheek a little bit because, you know, knowing that the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked outside of Christ, it's not necessarily completely out of the question that someone could have planned a early departure, but I'm not necessarily entertaining that idea, Charles. I mean, Justice Scalia had been on the Supreme Court. He was probably the most conservative jurist on the United States Supreme Court, had issued a number of dissenting opinions that read like fine literature. In cases like the Windsor case, the Obergefell decision, numerous cases where our traditional moral values are being shredded by the progressives through lawsuits in the courts. And you know, Scalia was a person who was an originalist, who believed in a strict construction of the interpretation of the Constitution, who believed in the balance of powers and the checks and balances that were inherent in that document, and was someone that I think we're going to have a very difficult time finding someone of the same caliber to replace him. But then again, we, i.e. the conservatives who love Scalia, probably won't get that chance.
I'm going to just inject a little bit of possibly what's a nuance in here. Now,
oh, please.
You said Scalia was a constructionist. And,
a strict constructionist, right. Originalist.
Yeah. And basically, Scalia always said, no, I'm not a constructionist. I'm an originalist. And there is a subtle difference between a constructionist and an originalist. And actually, one of the best explanations, color me surprised, I found was in Wikipedia. Believe it or not.
I know that is a surprise for you, as much as you don't want to go to Wikipedia for your sources.
I'll tell you what I do. I usually zap in and see exactly what they have to say, because it can give you a quick guideline on where to go to find out some stuff. But I found something that was basically, and I'm going to quote from it. Brett Boyce described the origins of the term originalist as follows. The term originalism has been most commonly used since the middle 1980s and was apparently coined by Paul Brest in The Misconceived Quest for the Original Understanding. I wonder what that book was about. It is often asserted that originalism is synonymous with strict constructionism, as we've kind of used it here. But it says both theories are associated with textualist and formalist schools of thought, but there are pronounced differences between them. Justice Scalia differentiated the two by pointing out that, unlike an originalist, a strict constructionist would not acknowledge that he uses a cane means he walks with a cane, because strictly speaking, this is not what he uses a cane means. Scalia averred that he was not a strict constructionist, and no one ought to be. He goes further, calling strict constructionism a degraded form of textualism that brings the whole philosophy into disrepute. Okay, I get what he is saying.
I do too, and it just makes me appreciate Scalia's intelligence and wit all the more.
Yeah, there is no arguing with that position. You know what he's saying essentially is that. There are words, and they are, no matter what you do, words are flexible, especially in English.
Yes.
The other day, my wife and I I'm moving out to the country, and so we're looking for trash pickup providers. Well, I was thinking about the word refuse. In English, and trying to teach someone who speaks another language that isn't like a Romance language or a Germanic language like English is a combination of. How would you teach them that refuse and refuse are the same word, but they have two different meanings?
Depending on the emphasis you put on them.
Exactly.
It would be difficult because, you know, if you think about Asiatic languages like Chinese, Japanese, etc., you know, they're idiomatic languages. There's like thought processes,
yes,
or pictograms in relation to, you know, what a word means. And it would be difficult. Okay, refuse and refuse. Okay, I refuse to have your refuse. That would be a real difficult one, even for some English speakers. You know, Chuck, one of the things I really love, and sometimes when I'm out on my social media, I'll find these little things where it'll be like lists of those like sentences that are made with the same word, and and depending on how you read it, the sentence reads differently.
Yes, exactly.
I'll post those up every once in a while because I really enjoy the flexibility that we have in the English language. Now, I'm not a type of person who believes that in a postmodernist frame of reference that words can mean anything you want them to mean. I just marvel at the fact that in our English language, words can be spelled the same and have very radically different meanings, but there was really, there is a purpose behind that.
Well, I'd like to go further on this article, too, because speaks to that. Here's the next paragraph. Originalism is a theory of interpretation, not construction. That's an important distinction, and again,
yes,
this is Scalia. However, this distinction between interpretation and construction is controversial and is rejected by many non-originalists as artificial.
Well, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, as Scalia said, the Constitution or any text should be interpreted neither strictly nor sloppily. It should be interpreted reasonably. Once originalism has told a judge that what the provision of the Constitution means, they are bound by that meaning, but the business of judging is not simply to know what the text means, interpretation, but to take the law's necessarily general provisions and apply them to the specifics of a given case or controversy, construction. In many cases, the meaning might be so specific that no discretion is permissible, but in many cases, it is still before the judge to say what a reasonable interpretation might be. A judge could, therefore, be both an originalist and a strict constructionist, but he is not one by virtue of being the other. Now,
Interesting.
What he just gave you was a layout of the theory, the legal theory of the common law. That's a common law understanding of what the how the law works. And the Bible itself is a common law document. And by that I mean, now I don't mean that the British wrote the Bible. I don't want to get into British Israelism or any of that stuff. Because I don't hold with that theory in the slightest. What it means is that case law applies to the litigants. That's basically what Scalia is saying here. He's saying that there are places where the law fits, but it has to be interpreted to do that. And that's what case law is about. That's what the case law approach is about. It's about looking at a particular case. You know, Paul cited it in the Bible when he said, "Do not muzzle the ox as he treads out the grain." What was he talking about? He was talking about paying pastors.
That's true. Exactly.
He was doing an originalist interpretation of that passage, which comes from the Old Testament in the law, and applying it in the New Testament to a pastor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which is a reasonable application of it.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a reasonable application of the law. And you know, okay, Scalia is not perfect. And sometimes he leaned towards, there's an interview that was done by Dr. Thomas Woods with Lou Rockwell. Now, you may not like Lou Rockwell. You may not know who he is. Lou is definitely an interesting individual with a lot of interesting things to say. I don't necessarily agree with all of it. Basically what they came out and they both came to the conclusion that, Scalia had some problems. He didn't mind, accumulation of power in the, in the executive branch.
Right.
He was a little, too friendly to that. And there were some other things. Occasionally he would come out with a goofy ruling. I can remember you and I talking in our class about a certain situation on the Fourth Amendment, that the only person who came out and voted correctly in an originalist understanding of how the Fourth Amendment was supposed to work was Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yes, if I remember correctly, I believe that case was King versus Kentucky. And that came out about, I think it was in 2010 or 2011. And I'm going to look it up.
You're
going to
look it up.
Right,
I know we've talked about this in our class several times, especially when we get into the area of the judiciary and the Fourth Amendment. And the Fourth, by the way, is the one that basically says you're secure in your persons, papers, houses, and effects against unreasonable search and seizure.
That's right.
And you apply it with the Fifth Amendment, which requires a sworn warrant for any search and seizure, essentially. And you've got basically what amounts to an ironclad right to be left alone by the government, essentially.
Right, exactly. And yes, I was right. It's Kentucky versus King. It was argued. It was cited in 2011 by the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a 8-1 decision. And the one person who voted actually in favor of upholding the Fourth Amendment in its originalist context was Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Will wonders never cease. Yeah.
We use this decision in our Institute on the Constitution classes to talk about being careful not to make too many assumptions, but to look and think through, you know, does the Fourth Amendment, and really the question was, does the Fourth Amendment allow police to be able to do searches and seizures in someone's private property without proper warrants? And of course, the majority in that case said, yes, of course it does. You know, well, law enforcement's our friend. Woo, we have to do this. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, first of all, normally is not considered a conservative voice on the court, but secondly, who also considered Antonin Scalia, and as she quoted after his death, to be her best buddy on the court, and obviously their families were very close, actually took a more Scalia-esque approach to the outcome of this case, by basically trying to defend the originalist view of the Fourth Amendment, that when it says that you're secure in your persons and papers from illegal search and seizure, and that law enforcement must go and swear out and get a proper warrant that has specifics, including the exact things that they're looking for and the exact persons that they're looking to search through from, or the location they're searching from, that it, no matter what the exigency might be, that that constitutional protection of the individual needed to be upheld. Now, sadly enough, again, with Justice Samuel Alito writing the majority opinion for that case, and seven other jurists, including Antonin Scalia, agreeing in principle and concept with their vote of Alito's position, they felt it's perfectly justifiable, given the circumstances, if a police want to basically do either a no-knock or a single knock and rapid enter on somebody's property in order to supposedly seize evidences of potential illegal activity. So, Chuck, you know, yes, we have that situation. And yes, Scalia, by and large, was a conservative, originalist pillar of the court. But even he could err sometimes, as we all do. None of us hold the truth perfectly, and sometimes we have a tendency to maybe get lost in the weeds a little bit, and I think that that's probably, this is one of those cases where they got lost in the weeds a little bit.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this is someone interviewed Ruth Bader Ginsburg and asked her about votes on certain things, and she goes, look, If I vote a certain way, I have to be able to find a way to explain it to Antonin. So if you, in fact, they were very good friends, and he also liked Elena Kagan. He thought she was brilliant. He thought she was wrong, but he thought she was brilliant. And this is a very good example of sometimes how you get along with your enemies. Something that I need to take a lesson in, and I'm actually, been thinking about that, how you get along with your enemies. You become friends with them, and then you discuss issues. Scalia also said, we have discussions. We sit around and discuss these issues before we write our opinions and decide how to vote. And he says, look, these discussions never change anybody's mind, or nearly never change anybody's mind.
Right.
But it does solidify the way we think about and when we write an opinion.
Yes, it does.
And that's an important thing. Now, what that says is it doesn't matter who you appoint to the Supreme Court. It matters a lot. And Antonin Scalia was an originalist conscience, if you will. I frankly hate that term. I had a senator in Michigan by the name of Levin. I can't remember which Levin. There were two brothers, Sander Levin and Carl Levin. Carl Levin was the senator. Okay. And couldn't stand him, but the ads came on for his reelection, and they would always come out. Carl Levin was called by Ted Kennedy the conscience of the Senate. Well, how would Ted Kennedy know? Because he had no conscience. Exactly what a conscience would look like, and I really don't like that term. He's the conscience, but Scalia, what really was the originalist conscience of the Supreme Court? John Roberts certainly is not an originalist. The closest thing that sits there now is probably
Clarence Thomas, probably.
Well, Thomas, but Thomas is awfully quiet.
Yes.
Although his decisions are powerful. Alito.
Sam Alito, yes.
Alito's, and again, just does not. He's not on the same platform as Scalia was. Just really not on the same plateau at all, on the same plane.
No, that's true. Now, I find it interesting, Chuck, in talking about Scalia, what you had immediately after his death, probably within a day, was the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, Senator from Kentucky. Funny how Kentucky keeps coming up into this. But Senator from Kentucky basically, going out originally and stating, we will not consider replacing Antonin Scalia on the court until after the presidential election or until after the new president is seated. Correct? I mean, that was what they were out there. So basically, they were trying to come out with this, and this was, just a few days ago after Scalia's passing. But then all of a sudden, you know, you had Chuck Grassley, who happens to be the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that is the committee in the Senate to which presidential nominees for the courts must go and be examined, have hearings held, you know, where they ask them, you know, about their viewpoints, of, you know, do they believe in the doctrine of stare decisis and yeah, all those good things, you know. And of course, the jurists all sat there and basically, either flat out lie through their teeth or obfuscate as much as possible in order to get on the court, because, you know, there are bear traps from both sides. The left wants someone who treats the Constitution as a completely living document that evolves, changes, mutates, and morphs at will. And there are those on the Republican side who are looking for someone who would make Antonin Scalia look like a liberal. So, you know, it's interesting that, you know, now that this opening has come up on the court unexpectedly, you know, obviously Democratic senators want to have Obama have another legacy by, you know, appointing another member of the United States Supreme Court. And I believe that, Chuck, if I'm correct, if my thought process, this would be his third appointment.
Elena Kagan.
And Sonia Sotomayor.
Yeah, he would have. This would be number three.
This would be his third appointment, and really, most people assume that if there was going to be an open appointment at any point during the rest of Obama's administration, it was most likely going to be Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who has been battling cancer, and who's also, I think, older than Scalia. So this actually has come as quite a shock, and I believe that the conservatives and/or the Republican Party in general have been thrown in a little bit of a tizzy. And so they're basically saying, well, no, we're not going to be doing this. But then Chuck Grassley comes out a few days later and says, well, we can't reject it completely out of hand. You know, we have to wait and see what's going on, which really kind of sounded like a backtracking, Chuck, a backpedaling, a walking away from this, well, some would say principled, some would say hardline stance by the Republican Senate leadership to basically say, no, we're not going to give Obama a chance to, you know, put another complete leftist on the court and throw the balance of power even farther out of whack. But then, of course, you know, the Democrats are moaning and groaning. And, you know, then you get all of this, you know, everything about, you know, all these other presidents in the past who, you know, didn't get appointments during an election year, you know, when the seat was changing, things of that nature. It's all up in the air, but I guess just yesterday, Chuck, on Thursday, Mitch McConnell and Chuck Grassley actually put a article that which appeared in the Washington Post, basically telling the Democratic senators that, no, we are going to take time and we're not going to be in a rush to appoint the next Supreme Court justice. Supposedly, this is a way to probably send that signal that they can't don't expect us to give Obama an appointment. Now, this is what it said. Okay, so here's the text of this letter to the Washington Post. This was from Mitch McConnell and Chuck Grassley, and it said, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia was a towering figure whose sharp wit and formidable intellect were rivaled only by a decades-long fidelity to our founding document and an enduring commitment to the rule of law. His death stands as a tragic loss for our country. Finding the right person to take the seat he occupied will clearly be a monumental task. It may be a consequential challenge, but we think it's one the American people are more than equipped to tackle. And I think it's interesting that they say the American people. Okay, Chuck, because think about this. How does an appointment to the Supreme Court work?
President essentially makes the appointment, although the way the Constitution is worded is he is supposed to consult the Senate.
Right.
And that is why what you will see is very often that a Supreme Court candidate has a Senate sponsor.
Exactly. Okay. So let's go on with their letter, and it goes on. It says, rarely does a Supreme Court vacancy occur in the final year of a presidential term, and the Senate has not confirmed a nominee to fill a vacancy arising in such circumstances for the better part of a century. So in other words, they're already telegraphing, yes, they've done it before. So there is precedent to do it. I want to point that out. So the letter continues. So the American people have a particular opportunity now to make their voice heard in the selection of Scalia's successor as they participate in the process to select their next president, as they decide who to trust to both lead the country and nominate the next Supreme Court justice. Okay, so it's very interesting, Chuck, because that's a hat tip basically saying we're not going to do this until after the presidential election has been finalized and we know who the new president is and when he gets seated. Or she, I guess, if Hillary happens to win. The letter goes on. How often does someone from Ashland, Kentucky or Ziering, Iowa get to have such impact? We don't think the American people should be robbed of this unique opportunity. Democrats beg to differ. They'd rather the Senate simply push through yet another lifetime appointment by a president on his way out the door. Okay, Chuck, let's deconstruct. What was wrong with that sentence?
A lot.
Okay. Well, let's just start with the most obvious. This whole lifetime appointment thing.
Right, exactly.
That is not what the Constitution says.
During periods of good behavior.
That's exactly right.
What the Constitution says.
Exactly. We just, because of lethargy and an unwillingness to impeach justices when they violate the Constitution with rulings, do we have lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court? Because and the Senate is, and the House are both equally to blame in that. So Congress needs to look at their own selves on that. Okay, the letter keeps going. This is just a couple more paragraphs. He says, we also know that Americans issued a stinging rebuke to this president and his policies in our latest national election, delivering a landslide for the opposition party as they handed control of the Senate to Republicans in 2014. Okay, that's fairly factual, Chuck, I think.
Yeah, not a problem.
Okay, not a problem with that. Okay, next paragraph. Given that we are in the midst of the presidential election process, we believe that the American people should seize the opportunity to weigh in on whom they trust to nominate the next person for a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. There goes again with their unconstitutional viewpoint. It is today the American people, rather than a lame duck president whose priorities and policies they just rejected in the most recent national election, who should be afforded the opportunity to replace Justice Scalia. Okay, Chuck. What is the fundamental flaw in this argument?
How can the American people weigh in on the process, first of all?
Thank you. That's exactly my point. This letter is, Chuck, is another way of trying to create that meme that you and I have heard so very often, usually once every 4 years, about how this has to be the most important and consequential election in our lifetimes. And if we don't get this one right, it's all over with. Now, Chuck, first and foremost, the American people don't make the selection. The president of the United States selects a nominee. He doesn't go to the American people and give them like a checklist or his slate
right.
card of people he'd like to see be on the court and say, hey, help me pick out who this person should be. You know, and give their stats and, you know, like baseball cards. He doesn't, you know, the people don't get baseball cards to then, you know, play and trade and say, hey, this is my favorite guy, you know, or my favorite gal on the court.
Right.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of the Sixth Circuit jurist. No, I like the Ninth Circuit guy over here better. We don't get to do that, Chuck. That's not the way our form of government works. Now, but the point is, it doesn't even really matter who we pick as president. And yes, I'm going to say that one more time so it sinks into our listeners. It doesn't really matter who we pick as president. What matters is because the president gets to select someone that they would want to be on the court, and then they hand it off to the Senate. And it's up to the United States Senate, both the Judiciary Committee for the initial screening hearings, and then to the full Senate for a vote of confirmation or lack of confirmation, to then allow a person to take a place on the Supreme Court. Not for lifetime, but that's how it's technically working right now, Chuck. But during periods of good behavior. In other words, if you stay within your constitutional parameters as a jurist and you don't try to legislate from the bench or issue executive orders from the bench through your rulings, then we'll allow you to continue to sit there. And if you don't do other things like, you know, any kind of high crime or misdemeanor, which is the same level for impeaching a president. So, Chuck, you know, we've got this situation here where the Senate Majority Leader and the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the two people who have the most control over this process, are really just playing a political game right now.
Well, okay. If they really
wanted to give the Democrats a good black eye, let Barack Obama nominate whoever he feels like and then take that nomination apart in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
That's what I think, Barry, because let's face it, how many Republican nominees have been destroyed by the Senate?
Well, we have a new name for that kind of destruction.
That's right.
It's called borking a candidate.
Borking. Yeah, exactly.
Because Robert Bork, who was a nominee of George Bush the First, being utterly, completely wiped off the face of the judicial map by the Democratic-controlled Senate Judiciary Committee when he was put forward for nomination for a Supreme Court seat.
Well, the same thing was attempted against Clarence Thomas, and unfortunately, what happened in that case is that, unfortunately, that's the wrong word. Unfortunately for the people that chose to do it, let me put it that way, because I like Clarence Thomas. What happened to their case was they overplayed their hand. They brought in this woman who essentially very clearly perjured herself, Anita Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Brought in other people to back up her story and who were themselves destroyed. Brought in people who they thought were going to be essentially bolstering their case against Thomas, only to have those people come in and say, no, he'd make a great Supreme Court justice. So in the end, when Thomas went into his speech, and unfortunately there's a lot of people out there who don't remember this because the audience is getting younger and younger all the time as we get older and older. But when he said this has been a high-tech lynching, he was correct. It had been an attempt at a high-tech lynching. They mm-hmm. were going to get him on there and embarrass him. Now, when people say that this is a racist country, I always point to Clarence Thomas and say, really? How many white people came out and said, you can't do that to this man?
Quite a few, if I remember correctly.
Oh, there were legions. Legions. You can't. People were outraged. Even people who opposed him were outraged at what had been done to him in the Senate. And they very clearly attempted to bork him. And it did not work out. It did not work out. Because people by that time were ready for it. Because if you recall, Bork was in, what, 87?
Mm-hmm.
And Thomas was in 89 or 90?
I believe it was 90.
I can tell you this. It had to be in 90 because I was working at a certain place that I didn't get the job until 1990. Because I remember having long discussions. And it was interesting to hear the discussions from people who were clearly taking their talking points from the media versus people who were reading on both sides of the issue, and people reading on both sides of the issue were saying, boy, I don't know. There's something wrong here. And people who were taking their talking points from the leftist media were essentially saying, oh, no, he's terrible. Oh, he's an ideologue. He raped these women, blah, 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 blah. So, that's the kind of thing you're going to see. And in fact, everybody should realize that if Barack Obama appoints some ideologue, which Barry, I don't think he can stop himself from doing that.
Well, no, of course not. It will be definitely someone to help carry the Obama agenda along.
It's going to be, it essentially will be igniting a battle that nobody should really wants to fight.
Now, you think that, you know, when Grassley and McConnell put this letter in the Washington Post, you know, that would be, you know, their thinking was, well, that's going to put a cap on it, and that's going to put people like Chuck Schumer and others in their place so that they can just be quiet and just do what we're directing, because, hey, obviously he's the majority leader of the Senate. However, just yesterday, Harry Reid, who is the minority leader of the Senate, basically said, in no uncertain terms, we expect a name from Obama in the next 3 weeks. So in other words, the Democrats are moving right along with this, just like they always do. And one of the points that I tried to point out a little bit earlier, but I want to make more clear, is part of the reason they're doing so is because McConnell and Grassley's letter just handed them a piece of ammunition.
Yes.
They just basically stated, hey, guys, yeah, okay, there is precedent for making an appointment in the last year of a sitting presidency during a presidential election cycle. Well, it's been done in the past century, as they said. You know, Chuck, I mean, that's really what they've done is basically hat tip that, you know, well, we really are just going to take the whole argument out of our own people's hands that we just don't do this during a presidential election. We don't appoint somebody. And that's fine. It's a minor point. But when you also take a look, and I'm looking at an article in Breitbart.com, we're basically announcing Harry Reid, Obama nominating Scalia replacement in, quote, a little over 3 weeks, unquote. The picture that goes along with this article on Breitbart is a group of, organized people, I'll say that, standing there in the cold in Washington, D.C. in front of the Supreme Court building with these big signs, many of which all say, fill this vacancy. The other ones who say, put the Constitution above partisanship. Another one that says, Americans deserve a court that works. And then one little red one in the corner that says, justice for all. Gee, do you think these are conservatives who are looking for a originalist who would fit in the mold of Antonin Scalia and keep the court on a nice level working arrangement that it might have been before him, you know, where you can sufficiently count on where that jurist is going to be in relation to our civil liberties and our constitutional republic? Or do you think this group is actually looking for somebody more to really tip the court in a single direction to the left?
Well, they want to use the court, obviously, as a super legislature. That's the whole point.
And I totally forgot. The group that arranged this photo op is People for the American Way.
Oh, gosh.
I just left that little tidbit out for a second. I apologize.
No, not a problem.
So really, are these the people who Mitch McConnell wants to pick the next president? Or the point is, Mitch, the people of Kentucky put you in place in the Senate, beyond, you know, my complete understanding. I don't know why they did. But your colleagues in the Senate placed you as the majority leader because these are the times when you're supposed to take real leadership and do the things for the if you believe that, as the Republicans say, that they stand for constitutionalism and a limited government and proper roles and responsibilities and all of the pablum that they say during the election cycle that they completely ignore any other time, then you, Mitch McConnell, are the one who has to basically man up and turn down any and every nominee that Obama sends forward until he sends forward someone in the mold of an Antonin Scalia. And Chuck, you know, as I was thinking about that, a name popped into my head almost immediately who I believe personally would be a fantastic replacement for Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. And his name is Jeff Sutton, who is a Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals jurist from Ohio, who was the opinion in the Obergefell case saying that the states had a right to limit marriage between a man and a woman. Now, do you think he's going to get a sniff?
Oh, are you kidding? Oh, let me tell you, unfortunately, he won't get a sniff from a Republican president either.
You read my mind. That's exactly the next question I was about to ask you. Yes. Okay, let's not kid ourselves, ladies and gentlemen. I don't care. The only person who could be elected president of the remaining folks that are out there on both sides of the both parties who would even remotely think about nominating someone like a Jeff Sutton to the United States Supreme Court would be Ted Cruz. Now, because I say that, Chuck, with full assurance, because Ted Cruz has already announced, without a doubt and without hesitation, that he will personally filibuster any nominee that Barack Obama brings forth the United States Senate for confirmation.
I'm going to be quite honest with you. I think that's a tactical error.
Well, I don't necessarily. I think it could be a tactical error in one sense because, yeah, it could be turned around on him if he becomes president. But again, I think what he's basically saying is I'm going to stand up and do what I normally do in the Senate because I'm still a senator as well as running for president. And I appreciate that. Yeah, I understand that there's a big pitfall in that, a potential pitfall of if you happen to get the presidency, then the Democrats and some Republicans are going to try to use the same tactics on your nominees. But, Chuck, that's never a excuse not to do the right thing.
Right, I agree with you. Okay, the reason I think it's a tactical error, and I think that it's a reasonable assumption, but the tactical error is that what if Barack Obama appoints a decent someone decent to the Supreme Court on the base? What if he decides to play a little chess and says, okay, Cruz is gonna filibuster my nominee anyway. How about if I appoint somebody he might like?
Well, okay, Chuck, let's you and I. If you got a couple extra cents that are laying around that you're not using, let's put them on the table on that one because I'd be more than happy to take your money.
I wouldn't bet a nickel on that because I think Barack Obama is incapable of that kind of strategic thought. I'll be quite honest with you. He is an ideologue with his eyes glued firmly on the goals that he has, and he's not a. He's not a subtle player. He's a bull straight through the obstacles kind of player. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of his term, when he was all faith and hope and all that stuff, he was able to pull that off. Now, lately, not so much, because people are seeing what the result of his ideological goals are. You know, as we adopt them, things aren't working out so well. But yeah, the reason I think that may be that's the only reason I can think of, and also it's a PR problem. But here's the problem: the PR problem that the Democrats have in several different decades near the end of presidential terms, they have passed Senate resolutions while they were in control of the Senate that said we're not going to even consider any Supreme Court. This is not. Two members of the Senate coming out and writing an op-ed piece. This is Senate resolutions that say we're not even going to consider your nominees. One was in 1960, and I think the other one was in, oh gosh, I can't remember when the other one was.
Mm-hmm.
But when members of, now again, Harry Reid speaking out of both sides of his mouth. Harry Reid has said. When the Senate was controlled by Democrats, we're not going to be dealing with this issue during this particular president's term. But now that it's the shoe's on the other foot, he said, well, you have to. It's a requirement. It's a constitutional requirement. That's the problem I have with the way these guys handle the Constitution these days. It's basically whichever provisions they can twist to make them work for their particular position at any given time, they go with. And when it comes time to actually obey it, when they're in power and making the laws, forget it. It's an outmoded document. It needs to be completely changed. Yep. And that's the problem you run into. It's a doormat that they wipe their feet on when they need to.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you said that because I really wanted to bring up. There's an article in Breitbart today. Called The Nuclear Option, and basically this is by Charles Hurt, who's a writer for Breitbart, who basically says that Cruz's threat to filibuster a nominee guarantees a radical. Now, he may be right, but I don't think it would have changed anything had Ted Cruz not said a word. I think you're going to get a radical nominee anyway, but it was his line of reasoning and argumentation, Chuck, that I wanted us to look at for just 2 seconds here. He says, he goes down, there's a couple, three paragraphs, and he's basically, he quotes what Cruz said on NBC's Meet the Press, that the Senate's duty is to advise and consent. We're advising that a lame duck president in an election year is not going to be able to tip the balance of the Supreme Court. And then that's the reason why he's going to filibuster them. But then Hurt goes on to say this, and I want to read this paragraph to you, Chuck, and then kind of unpack it just slightly. He says, but how does someone like Mr. Cruz make such a stupid, lazy, self-serving, and I would argue unconstitutional threat, such as declaring he will absolutely filibuster any nominee the president puts forward? He is saying that as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which he's on, Cruz is on the judiciary, he will refuse to even consider any nominee President Obama makes. Isn't he essentially saying that he is refusing to perform his constitutional responsibility to, quote, advise and consent, unquote? Chuck, help me out here. What's wrong with that line of reasoning?
Well, there's a lot of problems with the reasoning. It's not unconstitutional to filibuster. I don't know where he got that idea. And I'm going to tell you, if it's from Breitbart, Breitbart's in the tank for Trump.
Uh-huh. Yep, that's true.
And that's exactly what you're seeing there. You're seeing the fact that Breitbart is in the tank for Trump. I'm trying to find that article, by the way, so I can put it up for our readers. And when I do, we'll make sure we post it.
Right. We'll make sure there's a link to it. So,
Essentially, most of what he said there was utter silliness.
Okay. Well, the other thing is, too, and Hurt, again, he keeps going on later on and talking about this thing, and he like starts comparing Cruz to Chuck Schumer and blah, blah, blah. And then he says down here, but let's forget for the moment how constitutionally spurious Mr. Cruz's threat is that he will refuse to consider any nominee. Okay, Chuck, the one thing he's not doing is explaining what he believes to be constitutional, but he kind of did that inherently when he basically said that it's his, quote-unquote, that it's Cruz's constitutional responsibility to advise and consent. So
that's
in other
right.
words, Charles Hurt's basically saying, you must consent to what the president sends you. You don't have the option to say no. And honestly, Charles, I've not read much of Charles Hurt, but what bit I'm reading here, this guy is constitutionally illiterate.
Right.
And he's getting this right down here on this whole situation that he doesn't like this idea. And he wants to give, you know, Ted Cruz a black eye, and he's willing to do so by claiming that Ted Cruz is acting unconstitutionally. My thought, Chuck, is, Mr. Hurt, go back and get a copy of the Constitution and read it carefully. Look at the history. Look at the fact that filibustering of nominees happens on a fairly regular basis in our history. That it is a check and balance of the Senate. The reason why the president doesn't just get to nominate someone to the Supreme Court and then place them on the Supreme Court through the unilateral executive order pen is because the Senate has a check on the president's ability to pack a court.
Well, let's talk about the originalist intent of the Constitution with the Senate. You know, people have always kind of walk around dumbfounded. Why is it the Senate that has to advise and consent? Okay, this is part of what is true federalism, not the kind of federalism we have today, which is basically the federal government deciding how much power they're going to allow the states to exercise. That's right. The originalist viewpoint was that the Senate was the representatives of the state governments, not the people of the state governments in the federal government. In other words, the states were sovereign and independent entities who sent representatives to a federal government, and that federal government was to abide by the wishes of both the people through the House of Representatives and the state governments in the form of the Senate. When the Senate was changed from the states deciding how senators would be chosen, I will grant you that some states chose to allow general election of senators, but most states appointed their member of the Senate, and when that changed in 1914 or 1913, the revolution of 1913, then what really happened was the entire makeup of the federal government changed. It changed over to become from a federal system to a consolidated nationalist system. In other words, the national government gained all control, basically, because you've suddenly the states no longer had a voice in the federal government. Now, if we did things that way, I can guarantee you things would be very different, especially concerning treaty law, especially concerning Supreme Court nominees, especially, I'm thinking, concerning certain kinds of impeachment. But we don't do it that way anymore.
No, sadly enough, you're right.
And the fact is, you know, when people accuse us of being, oh, you're recidivists and blah, blah, blah. You want to go back to certain times. I do want to go back to certain ways that government is designed to work. Because as we experiment with other ways that government is supposedly going to work better, it doesn't work better. It works much worse. And that's where we are. And that's what we're dealing with. That's why, Barry, we're becoming so very divided in this country. There are people who, there are really three factions. There are people who understand how the government was designed and how it's supposed to work, and we're a very small minority. There are people who know there's something wrong, but they don't know what it is exactly. And there are people who say, no, we need to be progressive and try new ideas. And really, when you get down to the bottom line, the new ideas aren't new at all.
No, you're right.
It's old time. What they're creating is a monarchy. I mean, if you look at the way people look at a president, he's an elected monarch. And we elect a new king every 4 years.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And liberals love that. They like the idea that this king is going to issue decrees, and all the basically the Senate and the House do is sit around and basically give him all the budgetary considerations that he wants and all this other stuff they do. Well, gosh, that's a waste of time. You know, quit interfering with our king is basically the argument that you get. And there are members of the Senate who are like, our job is to support the king in doing anything he wants to do. And I've seen that it doesn't matter which party is in. It has nothing to do with party. Republicans do it, Democrats do it. And we can see it at the state level. Well, our governor's running for king, and therefore we need to give him the things that he needs to do so that he won't be interfered with in his attempt to become king.
Yes. Can't have that happen.
No, and it is a dangerous, dangerous, terribly dangerous way of thinking about this. And you know what, Barry? If you want to understand it, that vast number of people who know something's wrong, but they don't know quite what it is,
mm-hmm.
Those are the ones who should be taking our Constitution class.
Absolutely.
Because that's what we teach. And it's not because we're a couple of big experts on this situation. We understand, we have studied the history, and we've studied the legal aspects, and we understand how this works, and we want to pass that knowledge on to you. Now, does everybody that come out of our class think like a monolithically with us? No.
Well, I hope not.
Yeah, exactly. You're an individual. You're supposed to come up, you know, we give you the history. You are supposed to connect all the dots.
Yeah, and Chuck, I would not want them to come out and just basically regurgitate what we're saying, because that's the beauty of when you give somebody this information, then they can start putting pieces together with things that they already know from their personal experiences, and they can paint a much broader and bigger picture and sometimes come up with solutions that maybe you and I, because of our unique circumstances, wouldn't consider, you know? It's like looking at a diamond. You can look at it from different areas, and each facet's going to look a little different to somebody.
Exactly, exactly.
But the key point is that if you all start describing it together and you start jotting that down, pretty soon you know what they're talking about is a diamond.
Yeah, exactly. A diamond does not simply consist of one facet.
No, that's absolutely true.
Well, Barry, I'm looking at the time.
Yes, I know. Again, another week has gone by more quickly than we have time to fill in all the things we want to talk about.
Yeah, what else is new?
But, Chuck, we just hope that folks will stay with us. Remember, the South Carolina primaries today, so another useless exercise in determining who you're going to vote for in Ohio in March is going to take place and become national news.
Yeah, exactly. Folks, we didn't talk about the town halls, because the town halls, if anything, you know, we're not fans of the debate process. But if anything, the town halls are far worse than the debates because it's fluff. Meaningless completely, doesn't say anything, and that's why we really didn't feel too bad about not talking about it. Mm-hmm. So, okay, that being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. There are contact information for both Barry and I there. You can also listen to archives of these programs, and we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.